When we left the prophet Amos at the end of number 28, he had recounted for us, looking back over his prophetic ministry, the personal confrontation he had with Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, who worked for Jeroboam II at the side of the golden calf. And following a stern rebuke from this godless priest, because he had the nerve to come up north from the south and actually preach in the city of Bethel, where the king himself dwelt, Amos stands with eyes blazing and retorts, as in verse 16, "And now hear the word of the Lord. You have said to me, 'You shall not prophesy against Israel, nor shall you preach against the house of Isaac.'" In other words, you are one of those men who has fallen into the category of my previous message. You have told the prophet of God not to preach. Now hear the word of the Lord against you, verse 17, and he begins with the word therefore. This is the same word which was used previously as the preface to the judgment on the entire nation, and now Amos uses it as a preface on the judgment predicted on Amaziah. And he says, "Your wife will become a harlot in the city. Your sons and daughters will fall by the sword. Your land will be parceled up and given to others, and you will die on unclean soil." Four personal curses on this godless priest of Bethel. Then he summarizes it with one national prediction. Moreover, Israel will certainly go from its land into exile, because evidently this godless priest had been attempting to refute everything that Amos had been prophesying and preaching. In chapter 8, we are introduced to the fourth vision of Amos, and it is the vision of the summer fruit. "The Lord showed me, and behold, there was a basket of summer fruit. And he said, 'What do you see, Amos?' And I said, 'A basket of summer fruit.'" In order to understand this, we have to think about the climate in the land of Israel during this time. And I can relate it to the climate here during the last week, because this has been the week of the heat wave, which has killed so many people. We have lived through temperatures of 103 and 105 degrees. And a friend related it last week how she went to a grocery store and picked up a banana. And when she shook the banana, she could hear something sloshing inside the banana skin. I would call that a piece of rotten fruit. And that's summer fruit. It does not last. When the heat comes out, the fruit turns black and it turns rotten. And this is the way that God selects in vision number 4 to demonstrate the condition of the nation of Israel, like a basket of summer fruit, rotten and worth nothing, but simply ready to be thrown down the garbage disposal. And God sums it up when he says in verse 2, "Then the Lord said to me, 'The end has come for my people Israel. I will spare them no longer. The songs of the palace, these professional choirs, which sing now to the king and to his glory, will turn to wailing. There will be corpses in every place.'" Amos directs his message in verse 4 to the ungodly inhabitants in the land of Israel. And he refers to them again as he has before by saying, "Hear this, you who trample down the needy and do away with the humble of the land." And he says, "Here's what you say in your hearts. When will the new moon be over?" In other words, when will this special feast day be over that we may buy grain? I want to get back out to the marketplace. I want to make some purchases. When is this miserable Sabbath going to be over so we can open the wheat market? I see the same kind of trend in America today. We have lost our respect for the day which we as Christians have set aside to honor God. We traditionally have used Sunday as a day of rest. Although it is not the Sabbath, it is the first day of the week. And since the early church age, we have chosen to honor this day. But I can remember in my lifetime when seldom would I find a store open on Sunday. And I can remember when people would leave church in the morning and relax and fellowship and worship the Lord and read the Word and return to worship that evening. But the days of blue laws have gone because the merchants have been dissatisfied on Sunday because they have said, when will the Sabbath be over that we may open the wheat market? Just anxious to get back out there and get back to work and do business and work 7 days a week. And we are doing now, application-wise, what they did in the land of Israel in this time period, just greedy to get back out there and begin to involve themselves in the dishonest merchant system of the day. Because he says, you want to get back out there to make the ephah or the bushel smaller. Why do they want to do that? He gives us a picture here in verse 5 of both ends of a transaction. If you are the merchant and you are selling, then you want to make your bushel smaller without the customer knowing it. Take a bushel basket that's about 3/5 the size of a normal bushel, but tell your customer it's a bushel. And fill it up and say, here's your bushel, and charge him for a bushel worth of grain. And he says, in addition to that, you want to make your shekel bigger. They want to make the shekel bigger because that's going to take place during the purchase from the customer. When he brings something in to sell, when he brings grain in to sell, then you have shekels that are supposed to represent different divisions of weight. For example, 1 ounce. Well, your customer doesn't know any different. So you put an oversized shekel on the balance scale, which really weighs 2 ounces, and you tell your customer it's a 1 ounce shekel. So you buy from him 2 ounces worth of merchandise for the price of 1 ounce. And I'm reminded of the classic picture painted by Norman Rockwell, which was on the cover of Post magazine, about the butcher who had his thumb on the scale and the little old lady who had her finger underneath the scale on the opposite side, each one trying to cheat the other. But it wasn't funny in the days of Amos because you could not trust anyone in the marketplace. And I submit to you it's similar to that today because we have to have federal organizations to simply make sure that the scales and the gasoline pumps and everything are being handled correctly. And this organization is called the Department of Weights and Measures. And if we do not have dishonest people in the marketplace, we would not need a Securities Exchange Commission. We would not need a Department of Weights and Measures. But unfortunately, we live in the same kind of situation today that Amos did in those days, but there was simply no official control. And he says, you even buy the helpless for money. If you see people out here that don't have anything, you'll buy them, and then you'll turn around, and when you need a pair of shoes and have an extra slave, you'll sell them for just enough money to buy yourself a pair of shoes. And in addition to that, you even sell the refuse of the wheat. You don't even separate all the chaff from the grain. And have you ever experienced buying hamburger which has been filled with oatmeal because it cannot be seen? Well, certainly, people do that today. Honest butchers don't do that, but I've read articles in the paper about ones who have done that and have been caught doing it. Back in these days, they would take the chaff and mix in with the wheat so the bushel would weigh more and so that they could cheat their consumers. And now God says, because of this, the Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, I will never forget any of their deeds. And he says in verse 11, eventually there is going to be a famine, and not a famine for bread or a thirst for water, but rather for the hearing of the words of the Lord. Because God is going to go away to his place, and the voice of the prophet will not be heard in the land. And he said, all of you, in verse 14, who have been swearing by the Asherah in Samaria, and who have been saying, as your God lives, O Dan, that golden calf up there, and as the way of Beersheba lives, where that Baal system has been established down there in the Southland, you're going to fall and not rise again. Chapter 9 introduces us to the fifth vision of Amos, and it is the vision of the altar. Of course, this is the altar in the northern kingdom which is the altar established by Jeroboam I back in 931 B.C. and has been maintained by all of the kings since that time who have involved themselves in either Baal worship or the sin of Jeroboam. As we think about the altar, we must realize that the altar symbolically is a place which results in mercy because there has been a substitutionary sacrifice offered there. By interesting contrast, we know that in 1 John 2:2, Christ is our propitiation, and that is the same Greek word which appears in Hebrews 9:5 as mercy seat. So the new covenant is Jesus Christ becoming the mercy seat, the place of judgment for us. But when the altar of God is despised, then the altar results in judgment. We see this from John 3:36. Now, even though this is a northern altar, they are worshiping here because they have despised God's altar. And now the altar becomes a place of judgment. And this is the fifth vision of Amos. God stands beside this altar in the northern kingdom, and he gives instructions to destroy it, to hit the capitals, the headposts, so that the thresholds will shake and break them on the heads of them all. And I'm reminded of Samson as he leaned on the pillars in the Philistine temple in Judges chapter 16. And that pagan temple fell and crushed the heads of those people. And now God wants to do the same thing with this heathen altar. He said, I don't care even if they dig into Sheol, the grave, the netherworld of Baal. From there I'm going to take them and bring them down, even if they hide on the summit of Carmel, that revered headquarters of Baal. I'll search them out and take them from there. And if they conceal themselves from my sight on the floor of the sea, and these people knew the story of Jonah 30 years earlier, he said, I'll reach down there and take them from there. And I'm going to command the serpent, and it will bite them. And even if they go into captivity, from there I'm going to command the sword, and it will slay them. God now begins in verse 5 and reaffirms his omnipotence and his control over the physical universe. And beginning in verse 7, he takes the people to task for their belief that they are a unique people. Remember that the Israelites prided themselves on being an Exodus people. And, of course, God confirmed this over and over. Hosea chapter 11 and all of the other previous sections of the Old Testament in the various historical recaps and historical narratives where God, through the prophet, takes them back to their historic past and brings them forward to remind them how God has blessed them through the years. They are an Exodus people. Now he says to them in verse 7, are you not as the sons of Ethiopia to me, O sons of Israel, declares the Lord? Have I not brought up Israel from the land of Egypt and the Philistines from Kaphtor and the Syrians from Kir? God says, you are no longer special. I have brought other nations from other homelands just as I did you. And as far as I'm concerned now, because you are so wicked, you are just like the Philistines, you're just like the Syrians, and you're just like the Ethiopians. No longer does it mean anything to be an Exodus people. God again confirms the Davidic covenant. In verse 8, he says, the eyes of the Lord are on the sinful kingdom, that is the northern kingdom. I will destroy it from the face of the earth. Nevertheless, I will not totally destroy the house of Jacob, declares the Lord. So with that verse, we see that Israel will be completely destroyed in 722, but the nation of Judah will be protected. Beginning in verse 11 in chapter 9, we have our eschatological section, that the fallen booth of David will again be raised up, and it will be rebuilt as in the days of old. So at the time of national restoration, Israel can look forward to a return of a converted remnant. Again, as with the other minor prophets, we have that ray of hope, that light at the end of the tunnel, which after God's judgment has fallen, he will, in fact, continue to be faithful with this hesed love to the Davidic covenant which he promised in 2 Samuel 7. This concludes our study of Amos, and with this we have brought to a close the prophecies of the two men who were contemporaries and prophesied to the northern kingdom of Israel during the first part of the 8th century B.C. It is now necessary to move down in time to the latter part of the 8th century B.C. to pick up two other contemporaries who were prophesying in the south. And although Isaiah was a southern prophet, his prophetic ministry can be classified as universal. The pivot point in the book of Isaiah is Isaiah chapter 6, and the central theme, which all of the book of Isaiah revolves around, is the fact that Isaiah had seen the Lord, God of hosts, Jehovah himself. The book of Isaiah begins in the year 739 B.C. As we have discovered before, Uzziah the king died in 739 B.C. after he was smitten with leprosy as punishment from God because he attempted to offer incense in the house of the Lord. So the superscription which we have in Isaiah chapter 1 verse 1 indicates that his ministry was in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. He probably began his prophetic ministry in the last years of Uzziah's reign. But in the year that King Uzziah died, he received his official call into prophetic service. We know by this listing of kings that he was around for at least 40 years, and tradition has it that he was around even longer, assuming that he was martyred by Manasseh. With this in mind, we know the historical background against which Isaiah preached. The situation in Judah was somewhat similar to the situation as it had been in Israel some years earlier during the reign of Jeroboam II. Because he began his prophetic ministry in 739, we know that Isaiah was an eyewitness, as were the other kings of Judah, to the attack by the Assyrians, which completely annihilated the northern kingdom. So the inhabitants of the land in 722 and the years surrounding 722 had a graphic visual example of what God's judgment can do. And this kind of graphic illustration should have provided impetus to the message of Isaiah and the messages of the other prophets as well as they called the people to repentance. It is just difficult to analyze and summarize all of the tremendous truths in the book of Isaiah. His broad scope of revelation deals with everything from Satan in eternity past, as contained in Isaiah 14, all the way to the new heaven and the new earth, as contained in Isaiah 66. No other prophet in the entire Old Testament has the span of knowledge and the span of history and prophecy that Isaiah does. Without the prophecies in the book of Isaiah, there would be a large void in our knowledge of both prophetic events yet to come and the prophetic events which preceded the advent of the Messiah. He talked about the virgin birth. He talked about the deity of Christ and his eternal kingdom. He talked about the humanity of Christ as a root of Jesse. He talked about his righteous reign. He talked about the fact that he was the mighty God. He talked about his vicarious suffering and death. And he talked about his reign as king and the millennium and all the related events. It is because of the book of Isaiah that we are able to put together the sufferings of Christ and the glory which should follow. And if the other prophets had been able to completely understand the book of Isaiah, they would have seen that this is Messiah who was to suffer, and this is Messiah that was to reign. But what they would not be able to understand would be this church age gap, this parenthetical period, this hiatus in which we live now between the suffering of Christ and his glory which should follow. We need to look at the book of Isaiah as a book which was presented to the southern kingdom. We have seen many attempts to discredit the book of Isaiah, and especially in the area of the Deutero-Isaiah position, which says that the first 39 chapters in Isaiah were probably written by the historical Isaiah, and chapters 40 through 66 were written by some kind of a pious forger at a later date. I really cannot accept the Deutero-Isaiah position. This is simply an attempt to discredit the prophecies contained in the latter section of the book. Every literary expert will agree that the first 39 chapters appear to be written in a different tone than the latter section of the book. But Isaiah presented this material in two different time periods in his life. Extensive arguments can be presented, from the unity of the Dead Sea Scrolls to other extant evidences and arguments based on logic. However, I am not going to attempt to present all these positions here. I will summarize my position for the unity of Isaiah by reading John chapter 12, verses 38 through 40. That the saying of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spake, Lord, who hath believed our report, and to whom hath the arm of the Lord been revealed? Quoting from Isaiah 53:1. Therefore they could not believe, because that Isaiah said again, he hath blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, that they should not see with their eyes, nor understand with their heart, and be converted, and I should heal them. Quoting from Isaiah chapter 6, verses 9 and 10. The inspired word of God in the New Testament, in the Gospel of John, we have the assurance for our hearts that Isaiah wrote the first half of Isaiah and the second half of Isaiah as well. And let God be true and every man a liar. Let's continue our study in the book of Isaiah with chapter 1. It goes without saying that we do not have time to cover the entire book of Isaiah and look in depth at all 66 chapters. I will, however, attempt to comment on some of the high points of the book, realizing that other high points must be omitted simply because of the lack of time. Beginning in chapter 1, verse 2, Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth. God is personifying the heavens and the earth, and calls them to be his witnesses, as we discover he does later in one of the minor prophets. For the Lord speaks, and he begins to talk about Abram and his children. He says, Sons I have reared and brought up, this nation of Israel, this nation of Judah, but they have revolted against me. I have raised children, and now they've rebelled against me. He says, Even a stupid ox out in the field knows its master. When the master rings the bell or calls that it will come, and the dumb donkey knows how to go back to its master's manger or crib at night to get food, Israel does not know. They're just dumb like sheep. They just don't understand. Everything seems to be reversed. It's as it was in the days of Balaam, when the donkey prophesied and the prophet neighed. It's just opposite. And God says, Israel does not know. My people do not understand. And remember what Hosea said earlier. Harlotry, wine, and new wine have taken away the understanding. And that's what's happened. They don't understand. Their minds are clouded. They're confused. Through this Baal worship system, Satan has led them astray with the spirit of harlotry. Verse 4 continues, Alas, or ah, sinful nation. And with this, God is threatening immediate doom. Verse 4 begins a sevenfold indictment of sin. And I believe it's a sevenfold indictment because it shows that the sin is complete. They are perfect in sin. It's almost like a negative usage for the number seven. He says, Alas, sinful nation. That's number one. And compare that with Exodus 19, verse 6. People weighed down with iniquity. That's number two. offspring of evildoers. That's number three. Compare that to Genesis 21:12, where these people were to be the offspring of godly people. Sons who act corruptly. That's number four. And read Deuteronomy 14 in that regard. They have abandoned the Lord. That's number five. Read Deuteronomy 32, verses 11 and 12. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. That's number six. Number seven, they have turned away from Him. They have turned away backward. And there we have the sevenfold indictment of sin. And with this, we pick up the concept that there is simply no hope left. They have reached the point of no return. He said, Israel just does not understand. We continue now this concept of chastisement, because God says in verse 5, where will you be stricken again as you continue in your rebellion or turning away from the truth? In other words, where do I have to chastise you again as you continue to rebel? Right now, every head is sick, or the whole head is sick. Every heart is faint, or the whole heart is faint. And now he begins to describe Israel as having the disease of leprosy. Because in verse 6 he says, from the bottom of your foot even to the top of your head, there is no soundness in the entire body. As you look up and down your body, there are bruises and welts and raw wounds, these sores and weeping, oozing wounds of leprosy. He said, they aren't pressed out or bandaged. No one has even taken care of them. You would think that a person who had leprosy would press out these sores and get the pus out and the drainage out and bandage them up, and where these areas had become crusty on the skin, they would soften them with oil, which was used as a medicine in those days. But do you know why they had not pressed them out or bandaged them? And do you know why they had not softened them with oil? Because they were like a cake half turned. And they were as a man who had gray hairs on his head and did not know it. They were in this condition, but didn't even realize it. So now we have this physical infirmity, which is compared to the spiritual infirmity. And when I read this, I'm reminded of the classic novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, where from all outward appearances, as he went through life, he was beautiful and unmarred. But he was living such a life of sin that the picture in his attic took on the characteristics of his inner self. And this is the situation with Israel. This is the end of side one.